Cook Inlet remains a significant hydrocarbon basin in the state of Alaska.
Another big oil and gas lease sale for Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, better than coffee, an early morning earthquake jolts Anchorage residents.
I freaked out. I grabbed my husband and he told me to relax, and so it was pretty scary for me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
State officials say today's Cook Inlet oil and gas lease sale netted more than $6.8 million. Preliminary results indicate the sale is the second largest in Cook Inlet in a dozen years. Bill Barron, State Department of Natural Resources Oil and Gas Division Director, says five groups bid on 44 tracts.
Actually, we were very surprised with the attention that Cook Inlet drew this year. Last year's lease sale, Apache Corporation came in a significant way and picked up a lot of acreage. And we actually, in the division, anticipated this to be a fairly small sale, given that people were going to be waiting to see the results of some of Apache's 3D seismic work.
The three primary bidders at today's sale were Apache, Cook Inlet Energy, and a new player in Cook Inlet, Hilcorp. Again, Bill Barron.
And that was a real positive sign to see a company who focuses on older fields and development of old fields to step into an exploration role with new acreage potential. That's real exciting. It was good to see Apache kind of solidify some of their acreage, and I'm real pleased to see Cook Inlet Energy step in and pick up acreage along some of their trends.
Barron says the increased interest in Cook Inlet resources could be attributed to Apache's earlier exploration efforts.
The Cook Inlet remains a significant hydrocarbon basin in the state of Alaska. So I think what we're seeing is people looking at not only the gas potential market and the deliveries of gas to South Central Alaska, but also the Apache plays, which is targeting deeper oil.
State tax incentives have played a role in luring new development to the inlet. There's no tax on Cook Inlet oil production. Producers do pay a 5% royalty on new discoveries for the first 10 years. Barron says after today's lease sale, it takes about a year before exploration can begin. Recycling in rural Alaska can be an expensive logistical endeavor. And as recyclable material makes its way to local landfills, some electronics can threaten groundwater supplies. As part of our ongoing series on recycling across the state, KDLG's Dave Benninger looks at one Naknek resident's efforts to establish an economically viable means to recycle electronics in Bristol Bay.
When you think of the stumbling blocks to consistent recycling, what comes to mind? Sorting, driving to the collection point, teaching kids the three R's? Now keep in mind the couple of cans that slipped into the trash last week, and imagine if everything you wanted to recycle had to be shipped by barge to the nearest recycling facility. That's the reality for much of rural Alaska, and because of that big hurdle, the landfills are growing. But Holly Koning of the Bristol Bay community of Naknek knew that solutions could be found. She says recycling...
It's just always kind of been something I've been interested in. My parents are pretty environmentally minded. When I was a senior in high school, I did a magazine recycling thing, but it only lasted about a year, and then it kind of fizzled out.
To recycle those magazines, she set up a collection point down by the docks and loaded a container to go out of Bristol Bay at the end of the shipping season. The magazine effort may have fizzled, but the idea was good, and importantly, she discovered that some companies were willing to donate the logistics involved.
Northland Services has been kind enough to donate the shipping, but I do know it can be, you know, a couple thousand dollars at least.
So Holly, who's now studying at the University of Washington, shifted the focus to recycling electronics, something she says often gets overlooked. Electronics recycling includes things like
cell phones, cameras, washers and dryers even, TVs, VCRs, DVD players, ink cartridges. They'll take stoves, and I'm pretty sure that includes Toyo stoves.
And also things like copiers, faxes, stereos, and so on. So through her connections with Northland, she got a container down at the docks and established a small but dedicated network of volunteers to run collection during the week. Now the question was, where would the container of electronics go? She first looked at a firm in Anchorage, which would seem logical on account of the relative distance, but it was expensive, and ultimately many of the products would be shipped out of state anyway. So she talked to SBK, Green Century Electronics Recycling, in Tacoma, Washington. Chris Regis is the co-owner of that company.
Holly contacted our Tacoma office and was wondering what the fee associated with processing the material would be.
The fee, as it turns out, is free. That's because electronics recycling companies like SBK strive to recover as much material from products as they can, much of which can then be resold in the market.
We do practice reuse. So even as a computer doesn't work as a whole, we can use the parts and components to refurbish other computers. And then what is left over, we recycle responsibly, and we go for metal recovery.
And this, Regis says, works well for most of the materials he receives, not just computers. And electronics contain all types of materials that can be harmful in landfills. For example, the cathode ray tube monitors frequently replaced by flat screens contain lead. Other common electronics have cadmium, beryllium, mercury, and copper in them.
So as these things get tossed into a landfill and then begin to break down over time, those chemicals eventually end up in our water table.
And that's the key concern, that these chemicals can make it into the groundwater, which can lead to health problems, even cancer. And there's another thing. Hard metals like copper in the watershed of Bristol Bay, well, that's kind of a big deal around here. Regis says that recycling electronics not only prevents them from entering the water, but chip away at the need for new sources of some minerals.
We have already mined these things from the earth and built them into this material. Now as we recover and recycle, there's not as much need to keep mining the earth, which uses more of our natural resources.
So by reusing and recovering materials, Regis stresses that his operation is profitable. That's why he's able to offer the service for free. And if SBK recycles in an ethical manner at no cost to the resident, he says he builds equity in the community, which is part of his business plan. And for their part, Northland Services says the same.
It's a business decision that we've made. We've just decided to assist the different communities in Western Alaska with these needed services.
That's Maureen Fitzgerald, who works in logistics and operations with Northland. And she says that Northland would like to make similar containers available for Bethel, Kotzebue, Dillingham, and other villages served by their barges in Western Alaska.
As long as it benefits the community, we're definitely willing to do it.
Holly says she plans to continue the program if it's successful and is looking for a grant to fund keeping the collection point open. So, long about October, a container she hopes will be full of washers and dryers and computers and such will set sail from Bristol Bay on its way to the recyclers in Tacoma, free of cost. As for the carbon use needed to ship that distance, Holly says,
I'm certain that there are carbon trade-offs, but I think that because the Bristol Bay region is so close to salmon spawning grounds that it would be more beneficial for the community to remove those items and get them out of here. I think that that benefit would definitely outweigh the carbon footprint.
Maybe beating the carbon use is a project for the next ambitious young person in Bristol Bay. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, reviving a commercial fishery on the Yukon River.
There's lots and lots of fish. So they felt like people deserved to have a fishery out there. It's kind of all they got.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Climate change is causing ice withdrawal and creating stress for animals that live on it. When six seals started showing up on beaches off Barrow last July, some saw it as the latest evidence of global warming. As part of our series on climate change, Johanna Urich reports that tracking clues behind the ring seal's sickness created an international effort, with native hunters working with biologists in a way that may provide a model for responding to future changes in the Arctic.
It started when Jason Harriman, a wildlife biologist heading up a ring seal tagging study in Barrow, got a call from a co-worker about a seal that was on the beach with hair loss and skin lesions. Jason works for the North Slope Borough's Department of Wildlife Management, an organization with roots in the collaboration between Inuit whalers and biologists to document the abundance of bowhead whales. Jason was studying ice seals because they're an important food for native people.
So originally, I didn't think a whole lot of it. You know, it was one isolated incident of a seal up on shore.
Hairless seals had been seen before, but then more sick seals started showing up. The count that summer shows more than 100 ring seals hauled out on beaches along the North Slope Borough, half of them dying. Willard Neacock from Point Lay says last summer, sick seals were a common sight.
My wife and I would go out every weekend or after work to enjoy the day if it's nice and calm. And we see, you know, seals here and there that are, you know, too weak to move, or they would have lesions, hair loss, mostly around the flippers and the head.
Willard monitors the walrus haul-out at Point Lay. He reported seeing walruses with skin lesions. They also appeared sick. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declared an unusual mortality event, setting up an investigative team with Raphael Stimmemeyer from the borough's Wildlife Department in the lead. This was the first such event that involved animals people rely on for food. Hunters taught by tradition not to eat sick animals did not eat the meat, but some hairless seals were fed to dogs, to no ill effect. The more scientists looked, the more they found. Sick seals were showing up all over the Arctic, and it wasn't just ring seals, but other ice seals. Scientists ran a host of tests and found no clear cause for the disease or syndrome. This spring, Raphael Stimmemeyer met with Russian biologists and hunters to set up a cooperative research effort.
All of the haulouts are in Russia. Alaska only has Point Lay now for a couple of years, or the haulouts out on Bristol Bay, or the small haulouts out on St. Lawrence Island.
Среди моржей, наверное, впервые мы обнаружили в 2002 году.
Anatoly Kochnev, a biologist working with native hunters in Russia's Chukotka region, speaking through a translator, says they first noticed walruses with skin lesions 10 years ago.
We believe we're seeing more walruses with skin lesions, so the disease seems to be spreading, but very slowly. Whereas, as far as seals are concerned, we're experiencing an explosion of this disease in Chukotka.
Я сейчас точную формулировку не помню, которая меня сразу натолкнула. Я вспомнил рассказы про медведей.
Anatoly surprised the meeting with indicating that polar bears had been seen hairless with skin lesions.
Information that I heard from traditional hunters about polar bears that had hair loss and skin problems, and they were always linked to the absence of ice and the need for the bears to swim for a long period of time.
A few weeks later, during a survey of the Beaufort Sea, polar bears were found with hair loss and skin lesions off Alaska. Scientists don't know what is causing the symptoms. Raphael Stimmemeyer goes so far as to say that they may never know the precise cause because it might be a combination of changes in the environment.
Sea ice retreat, plus long distances travels, plus, you know, not enough available food, warming of the water. You put all of these things together and you suddenly can end up with a new disease syndrome.
I'm Johanna Urich.
Shell oil officials are hoping to begin exploratory drilling in the Chukchi Sea this summer, searching for offshore oil and gas. Environmental organizations have filed suit throughout the permitting process, claiming not enough is known about the fragile Arctic ecosystem. But Shell leaders say there is a substantial amount of science from numerous sources that has been compiled over at least four decades. Michael McCrander is the lead scientist for Shell Arctic Research. Shell is using acoustic monitoring to better understand how whales respond to noise. This is a sample of the whale calls they've recorded. McCrander says the monitoring has shown the whales tend to stay away from industry activity.
That's a good thing to a certain extent. You want them to self-protect. And science, not so much science that we've done here, but a lot of work with marine mammals, et cetera. There are numbers, decibel levels, that people believe could cause temporary threshold shift in hearing issues. And what interestingly we find is that they stay away from those sound levels. It's almost as if there was a line in the ocean and they won't get any closer than that, which is generally a good thing. They do not, however, seem to significantly change their migratory pathway. They go around, continue on their path, go essentially back to the path that they had been on and continue on their way. And we see that they reduce their calling rate. They generally go quiet for a period of time. So really the area of significant effects is within about 3 to 5 kilometers of a seismic operation. We're not sure what it's going to be with a drilling operation. We hope to find out this year.
When you're out there doing research work, are there scientists who are not employed by Shell that you're working with?
Actually, there aren't that many scientists who work for Shell that are out there doing the work. We rely very heavily on contracting scientists. There are scientifically oriented contracting companies that do this. There are also universities that do this as well. And a large part of our program is actually conducted by people at several universities, most notable University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our approach is to find the best people to do the work, the people that have the knowledge, the expertise, the track record of working safely in the Arctic. And so we are working with a broad array of highly professional people. If you look at the people that work for us and you look at the people that the National Science Foundation are funding to do work in the Arctic, it's high, high correlation.
How receptive are your bosses at Shell to potential bad news that may make permitting more difficult? How autonomous is your work from corporate messaging?
It's part of Shell's corporate policy to be transparent and to be responsible and to operate in sustainable ways. So I think there's a recognition in Shell in particular, but I think probably more broadly through industry, that it is not a good business mode to not have the right answers. So it's about finding out what the correct answers are, and if that means that we have to change our operations in some way to mitigate potential impacts, et cetera. It's far better to do that beforehand than to go down a path and find out 5, 10, 15 years from now that there was a problem and then it comes back.
Michael McCrander is Shell's lead scientist for Arctic Research.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Another weak king salmon return is forecast for the Yukon River. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Yukon Area Management biologist Steve Hayes says this summer's Chinook run is predicted to be up to 146,000 fish, in line with weak runs since 1997.
Historically, these run sizes on average used to be 300,000, so we're seeing about half the fish we used to see.
Hayes says if the forecast is realized, it will be another summer without a commercial Chinook harvest and limited subsistence fishing. Meanwhile, the summer chum run on the Yukon is expected to be average to above average, with up to 2 million fish coming back. A regulatory change made by Board of Fish this spring will allow a Middle River commercial fishery. The new rule is specifically aimed at reviving commercial fisheries in the villages of Anvik and Kaltag, where local processing plants have been closed or crippled by fishing limits. Kaltag plant operator Doug Carlberg proposed the change and welcomes its approval.
This is a really, really old fishery, and for the last 15 years, it's just basically been shut down, and there's lots and lots of fish. So they felt like people deserved to have a fishery out there. It's kind of all they got.
Carlberg credits support from local people, businesses, the state's Hayes, and the governor's office for getting behind the regulatory change. He says fish wheels set up with padded ramps enable operators to divert kings back into the water unharmed.
The beauty of it is the fish comes out of the water, and 5 to 10 seconds later, without hardly any handling by human beings, give it a nudge with your fingers and it slides off to a chute and goes right back up in the river.
Carlberg says testing has shown a nearly 100% survival rate, and observers will be used to monitor that this summer. In Unalaska, there are a few big signs that spring has arrived. Crocus are coming up, the snow is starting to melt, and most significantly, the bald eagles are on attack. As KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports, trouble with the birds has started up again.
Like clockwork, the ominous signs show up every May. Danger, nesting eagles. They're placed near Unalaska's clinic and post offices, and they feature a silhouette of a bird extending its talons toward a terrified human being. The city's Department of Public Safety put them up last Wednesday, after getting the first report of a bald eagle attack this year. According to Deputy Chief Mike Holman, the incident took place outside the Illilouk Family and Health Services Clinic. Holman says that while bald eagles have wounded people in the past, this attack wasn't anything serious, just a swooping.
Nothing that was resulting in injuries, just some fear.
Eagle-human relations are peaceful in Unalaska for most of the year, but once they begin mating, the birds become territorial. The fact that bald eagles are especially plentiful in Unalaska means that encounters with human beings are almost routine. When I call U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesperson Bruce Woods to learn more about eagle safety, he says he's been expecting me to get in touch. He says that there are probably more eagle attacks in Unalaska than any other place in the United States. He's even had a run-in himself.
When I was out there years ago, I got swooped by one just because I was climbing up on this little dirt hill to get a better look at the nest.
Woods says that if you want to avoid getting attacked, you shouldn't do what he did. He says to respect the eagle's space and to observe them at a distance. If an eagle does start stalking you, you should put up your hands and make yourself as big as possible. And if it comes down to it and an eagle does make contact with you, Wood says you shouldn't worry too much about legal penalties for swatting the national bird away.
Well, if they're not actually trying to hurt the bird, I mean, if they're waving their arms in the air and they accidentally hit the eagle, it's not likely to do any harm to the eagle, and I can't imagine that anybody would press any charges over something like that.
On Tuesday afternoon, Clinic Finance Director Tom Small and I decided to take a look at the offending eagle from the safety of the building's entrance. The nest is about 5 feet wide and set into a cliff that overlooks the clinic parking lot. Small says that this bird has been responsible for a number of attacks over the years.
From that nest right in front of the clinic here, I've heard of two or three that people have come into the clinic to get treated for various scratches and cuts.
The nest was recently deemed to be a danger to the public, and Fish and Wildlife granted the city of Unalaska a permit to remove it. But because mating season began before the snow started melting, the nest can't be taken down until at least the fall. Small says that the clinic's patients will just have to remain vigilant in the meantime, and if they do get attacked, well, at least they're in a convenient spot for that to happen.
50 feet away from the clinic doors, and we can patch them up and get them on their way.
The clinic staff will be standing by for eagle-related visits through July, when nesting season ends. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
An earthquake struck Anchorage this morning, just as many residents were beginning their day. The 4.7 magnitude quake shook the city at 7:03. There were no reports of damage, but the earthquake was centered right in town, so it felt very strong to most residents. APRN's Heather Arono hit the streets at lunchtime to gather some reactions.
My name is Tracy Wright, and my daughter and I were getting ready for work and school this morning. We just felt one big jolt, but it did seem pretty big and close. And then that was it. It was over.
So my name is Dane Kettner, and I was actually back in bed with a cup of coffee, and the house started to slightly rumble, and I was anticipating another arrival. And of course, then after the surface waves started hitting, the whole house really started to shook. So yeah, we felt it.
My name's Georgiana McCumber. I was up early this morning, and we felt an earthquake, and this was my very first time in an earthquake, and I freaked out. I grabbed my husband, and he told me to relax, and so it was pretty scary for me.
My name is Bobby Brown, and actually I was in the restroom, of all places, and you could hear it rumbling and coming through, and then it hit, and earthquakes don't bother me none. The first one is all right. It's what comes after, for the most part, so I don't mind them at all. You know, the children were like, Dad, you know.
My name is Patty Ginsburg, and I'm embarrassed to say that I was in bed when the earthquake struck, sound asleep, and I didn't know what happened. I thought the dogs had either jumped up or off the bed. And my husband said, "It's an earthquake." And I was like, "Huh? Huh?" The dogs knew it. They reacted.
Anchorage residents sharing their thoughts about the 4.7 magnitude earthquake that hit the city this morning. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Heather Arono from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.